The annual production of PrEP chemicals has increased 500-fold in the last 60 years and continues to increase at an exponential rate, doubling every 7 years. The case of Bhopal illustrates the utter failure of the national and international systems of justice against corporate crimes. Thanks to the collusive Indian government, the corporation got away from civil liabilities, paying a paltry settlement at a cost of 48 cents per share. The situation with respect to criminal cases is even more pathetic. The corporation and its chairman were charged with manslaughter, reverse assault and other serious offences. They are absconding from the court proceedings for the past 10 years. Yet, the Indian government remains to take the tiniest step to extradite Anderson and call up our representatives. Meanwhile, the victims of carbine have to argue their individual cases for compensation in the claim tribunals, be interrogated like culprits, and then paid the equivalent of about $400 for lifelong injuries and less than $3,000 for death. The International Court of Justice said it doesn't consider cases against corporations. It just takes between nations. And of course, there's a class action suit going on in the US federal court. Darshan ICL is our attorney. He can tell you about it. But that's all that is there. So what I would like to emphasize is that monetary compensation for life, health, and the environment have demonstrated little effectiveness at all in regulating corporate conduct. More often than not, corporations find insurance companies, court-assisted deals, and government grants to cushion the shock. At a fundamental level, compensation distinguishes and hides corporate crime and legitimizes violence by putting an economic value to it. To paraphrase Balzac, behind every corporate fortune lies a corporate crime. These can only be regulated by veteran criminal justice. In terms of regulation of conduct of individual corporate executives, compensation is useless because the executive loses nothing, and like Carbine's chairman Kennedy, who came after Anderson, may actually make a profit while the corporation pays out. Senior executives of corporations who continue to reap astronomical dividends must not be allowed to indemnify themselves behind the corporate identity. It is my contention that in addition to corporations being made criminally accountable, individual officials of the corporation responsible for these crimes must be charged, tried, and adequately punished. Precautionary principle will only begin to make sense to individual executives when some of them experience that being otherwise threatens their personal luxuries and freedom. Bhopal tells us that in addition to corporate murder and assault, failure to disclose hazards and hazard mitigation plans, misinformation regarding chemical store, produced, spill, leak, emitted, dump, suppression of information critical to individual and public health and safety, following double standards of safety in different countries, choosing unsafe technologies when safer alternatives are available, and other instances of premeditated violence upon people and the planet must be treated as criminal offense. In all cases of corporate crime, the burden of proof must be on the offending agency. In the end, I'd like to stress the fact that the killers of Bhopal roam free, and this is a message to all corporations that in the pursuit of profit, they can go ahead and kill and maim people. It is time to give that we give the corporations a different message.
I'd like to now introduce Yin Chao Lin of the Third World Network. And he's going to tell us what his organization set up. That's part of his organization.
Okay, I'm going to focus on the issues of what the system represents for everybody involved in it, the whole world, and what we can do about it. And perhaps, as Tony said, there's very substantive reasons for calling for a framework for corporate accountability. Now, the system we have now today is just the latest attempt to institutionalize and cloak in respectability the business of exploitation and continuous colonialism. And it's up to us now to make it unacceptable, because colonialism once managed to find a universal rejection, both north and south, that it was unacceptable. And we can do the same now because the system is still continuing. We can do it, but people have to realize that the system is fundamentally unacceptable. Because the transnational corporations, by their very nature and by their very mechanism, generate crisis and inequality wherever they go. The crisis they generate is of a financial nature and an environmental nature. And this has been seen through history.
we've learned, you know, through the many, many years, the rise of the environmental movement, the latest round in the 90s was the financial crisis in East Asia, in Argentina now, in Mexico in 1995, and so forth, that all these financial mechanisms, financial corporations, the multinational corporations, they all transmit instability and degradation throughout the world. Now, you can see this for history. I mean, mainly at first there were states involved in exploitation. You know, you had the British Empire and so forth. And you had things like the East India Company who helped facilitate the system of exploitation. And a huge part of the institutions built up in the City of London now today that operate in global capitalism, as you put it, were built up around the East India Company. Now, the East India Company eventually collapsed, but the institutions that it spawned carried on, and they just spread around the world. And, you know, the banks that were funding the East India Company then exist today. You know, your Lloyds, your Standard Chartered, and so forth. They're still funding the same kind of exploitative and damaging investments around the world. And the effect that it had was not only exploitation in the South, but it created an incredible dependency in the North. By bringing in all this wealth and dumping in the North, not only was there exploitation of workers there, but it created incredible dependency, because once all this huge amount of disproportionate wealth is brought in, if it vanishes suddenly, what can you do? Everything will collapse. So you can't simply begin to just remove the system and leave a vacuum. There needs to be a sort of dismantling process in place. Now, what happens was this dependency has spread worldwide, such that, you know, all states everywhere are dependent on these corporations and the kind of capital that they produce. And what happens is that governments are held hostage. You know, a government may, against its wish, have to sell arms, as happened to the United Kingdom a few weeks ago during the high point of tensions between India and Pakistan, where the government was forced to put in arms deal. Because the defense company, which was in Deputy Prime Minister's constituency, said that jobs would be lost unless the deal was pushed through. And, you know, governments, whether they like it or not, and some do, are just pushed by this system of dependency, because jobs will be lost, people's lives and livelihoods will be lost. So it's really the transnational corporations that have to be tackled. Now, the Earth Summit in 1992 had a promise of bringing in this kind of regulation that was needed, because the UN Center for Transnational Corporations was established. You know, there was actually an institution established within the United Nations to deal with the regulation of transnational corporations. It existed before, and it can well exist again. But it was squashed because of the efforts of the transnational lobby. But there's no reason why we cannot bring it now with this kind of frame of conventional corporate accountability. I mean, UNCED failed in many ways because it lost out. I mean, if you read the Agenda 21 document, it's always referring to the Uruguay round, which eventually became the WTO.
And explain what UNCED is?
Oh, sorry. UNCED is the acronym for the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development, which is also known as the Earth Summit. If you look through the document, it's always saying, okay, we'll defer economic questions till the Uruguay round. And look what we have now. We've got the WTO, which is basically a protectionist mechanism for, you know, the developed countries and their transnational corporations to continue exploiting developing countries around the world, and also continue exploitation within the developed countries as well. It's completely unacceptable, and really it has to change. But the nature of transnational corporations has also shifted. They're no longer so centralized anymore. As we've seen with the Enron case, the accountancy firms are deeply, deeply, deeply involved and mired in this situation as well. And it's hard to put your finger on, you know, who to control. Do you control something like BP? But then BP's financial department is actually being run by PricewaterhouseCoopers now in Portugal. So the system's become, you know, spread out, but they're all still transnational corporations. They're all still immune to regulation. And it's unacceptable when the same companies which are helping companies dodge taxes are also doing the audits with governments to try and collect those taxes as well. The accountancy firms have to be hit too. Now, the transnational, you know, the UNCTC, the Center for Transnational Corporations, needs to be brought back. Instead, we've got this global compact, you know, keeping business as a privileged partner, and it's totally flawed because it's a system of appeasement. A system of appeasement rather than control. Governments are held hostage. You see, basically what's happened is we've got this PrepCom, for the World Summit on Sustainable Development in the United Nations next door, and almost all the important delegates have gone over to the World Economic Forum to lobby the business delegations there. And that just shows you the balance of power that absolutely needs to change. It has to be reversed. And the only way that can be done is for popular citizen movements to drive this change through. The governments will not do that on their own because, as I said before, they are held hostage. They were held hostage, and they will do the bidding of these transnational corporations in your name. And they'll say, we cannot hurt the people because the transnational corporations hold these jobs which many of us are employed in. And the thing is, we have to begin to spread the word that it's unacceptable for all of us to be complicit in this incredible, terrible system of exploitation and environmental degradation. The message has to go through. The lies of greenwash, of PR, corporate PR, we just have to stop believing them, and the word has to go through. And, you know, it's very easy for people to fool themselves with all these coping mechanisms. I mean, it's no longer the Protestant ethic that drives, capitalism. You know, Max Weber's great unwritten book of this century is really the Taoist ethic of global capitalism. You know, you can do your workplace meditation, but really the kind of, to cope with it, but the incredible spiritual degradation that goes on within the transnational corporations is killing people as well. Everything has to change. And everyone has to be convinced that the change is possible. That's the key thing. The change is possible. And solutions such as Tony has proposed and many others, and my organization is similarly supporting a campaign for a corporate-free UN. I think we should go ahead with that. We should put our full backing behind it and get everyone to sign on and yell it loud and clear to the governments that no longer do we want our countries and ourselves be held hostage to these transnational forces, and they instead must serve us.
I want to ask you more about those particular actions that your group is taking, but let's hold that for the discussion. And right now, we're going to have Peter Madden, heavyweight champ of the Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs of Britain. This is a one damn British panel, I have to say. Lousy with Brits and Stewards. I have to step out for a minute. It's no reflection on DEFRA, or sometimes called the DEFRA Blind and Dumb, but this is the Department of Hoof and Mouth Disease. They take a lot of ribbing on some of this. At any rate, Peter Madden is going to discuss some real solutions that we can push for. Thanks, Peter.
I want to talk to you about transnational corporations and their role in the global economy. First of all, I want to ask what the problem is. And I don't think that the problem is international trade per se. International trade is important, it's good, it's happened for thousands of years, it transfers knowledge, technology, it brings us our tea and coffee, orange juice every morning. I don't think the problem is international trade in itself. Nor do I necessarily think the problem is transnational corporations in themselves. Do they lower social and environmental standards? Well, the evidence is mixed, and I don't think that we can comprehensively say around the world that transnational corporations have lower standards than domestic national companies. And there are problems with both of them. For me, the real problem with transnational corporations is about power and accountability. It's their size and role in the global economy and the lack of governance. The top 200 transnational corporations are responsible for around a third of the world's economic activity. And the governance system we have on the international level, based on the UN, is based around countries. So all the negotiation, all the regulation, all the institutional architecture is about interactions between countries rather than companies. So I would agree with Tony Junior that the debate here is about rights and responsibilities. Transnational corporations responsible for many, many new areas of our lives. Where is the accountability, particularly if they're being run from the other side of the world? What's my government doing? Well, the UK government has a fairly positive attitude about the role of transnational corporations and big business in poverty alleviation and sustainable development, and it tends to try and work with them to encourage higher standards and more engagement. And around the World Summit on Sustainable Development, which we've been talking about, it's working with NGOs and business on water, on energy, on sustainable tourism, on principles for finance, to try and get some positive outcomes. And it supports a whole load of voluntary initiatives in the UK, labelling, codes of conduct, You'll have heard of the Fair Trade Movement, the Ethical Trade Initiative. It supports the big international voluntary codes, the OECD guidelines, the Global Reporting Initiative, the UN Global Compact. And we have a Minister for Corporate Responsibility to coordinate our work across government. Lots of good stuff, lots of valuable stuff, but I think the problem with all of this, as other speakers have suggested, is that it's voluntary. It's all based on corporations addressing these issues in a voluntary way. So where should we go and what should we try and do? I agree with all the speakers that this is an important issue. I think there's a gap in reality between what's happening on the ground and what institutions are doing, between what governments are saying and from what ordinary people and consumers and citizens want them to be saying. But having said that, we need to be real about the politics. I've been across at the UN preparatory meetings for the last few days, and this issue isn't even on the agenda. It's not even being discussed. There isn't a single country in the world that is putting forward proposals for regulations of transnational corporations. So it's as if the whole system is blind to this issue. It's going to be very late to get it onto the agenda for the World Summit on Sustainable Development. And it's difficult at the moment to see who are going to be the governmental champions for this issue. So rather than go down the line that a couple of speakers have suggested and say we need a global framework, a new convention on corporate accountability, which looks like an enormous step for governments to take, I think that we might want to break the issue down into a number of smaller bites, smaller chunks, and see if we can address those. And I'm just going to suggest three ways we might move forward. First of all, we do have these OECD guidelines on corporate responsibility. Not perfect, but they're something that all the major countries, the rich 24 nations of the world, have signed up to. One way we might move forward is to try and get an African version of this, an Asian version of this, a Latin American version of this. If you could get these codes, similar codes, in place in different areas of the world, everyone's got similar codes, then it'd be much easier to turn those into one single global convention. Second area we might try and do more is actually on using individual governments' power and spending, particularly in northern countries, to demand better standards. Now, in the UK, my government's public spending is responsible for about a third of the economic activity in the economy. So we should be using our power to demand, if we're funding export credits, to demand high environmental standards. We're looking at sustainably produced and illegally logged timber at the moment to see if we can promise that the government and all its agencies will only purchase timber from companies that meet those standards. And thirdly, I think we should be trying to focus maybe on individual parts of the agenda. Corruption. Who can be against a convention on corruption? And it looks like there is now a global attempt to see if we can agree and sign a convention on corruption. Reporting and transparency. Can we make this mandatory? Can we say that a core number of issues, social and environmental issues, that all major corporations over a certain size have to report on? Disclose, for example, payments, political payments, to governments made around the world. And thirdly, liability. In the UK and in the European Union, we're looking at environmental liability regimes, so that if corporations do break environmental laws, they can be sued, they can be held accountable, you can make the polluter pay for what they do. Can we look at more global liability conventions, or the ability to sue the parent company, for example, for what its subsidiary does in developing countries? So that's a couple of ideas. I think that we do need to have rights as well as responsibilities for companies. We do need to update regulation, but we may have to work issue by issue rather than going straight for a global convention. I think it was Nelson Mandela who said, if you're going to eat an elephant, you have to do it mouthful by mouthful.
Thank you. One thing I want to ask is how it is inside. We talk about countries, England's position, America's position, but when we have someone from the inside, how does the discussion go internally? Keep that thought for our discussion and practical value. So I got it. Can all of you see this document?
No. Good, you're not supposed to. It says, for official use only, the World Bank. This document has a restricted distribution, may not be used by recipients, may be used by recipients only in the performance of their official duties. Well, my official duty as your moderator and as an investigative reporter is to show you this document and tell you what's in it.
In Britain, this would violate the Official Secrets Act to show you that we would. Do it anyway. It's the what they call the country assistance plan for Argentina, and you know how they've been assisting Argentina. It's a memorandum signed by James Wolfson, president of the World Bank, dated June 25, 2001. Many interesting things in here, but some of the most interesting discussion is directing Argentina to finish off the privatization of its water, gas, and electricity systems and to liberalize their markets for basic public services. It's very interesting. Now, here's another document. You can see this now. It's a bunch of numbers. Okay, and there's a direct link between that document on Argentina and this document, which came from a set of books kept in the trunk of a car of a vice president of a company called Southern Company of Atlanta, Georgia. And what this is a record of accounts in which the company was keeping record of about $117 million in phantom parts from their power plants. So they were using kind of phantom accounting. Now, they were facing indictment. Grand jury voted to indict, but the Bush senior administration in 1989 said that an indictment could not be brought. That's the prerogative of the Justice Department. And they were convinced that there should be no criminal indictment because they got a note from the company's auditor, Arthur Anderson, saying that they approved of this odd procedure of keeping a special extra account books in the trunk of their car. Now, that was a very important date, because that's the beginning of the business that we see today. Because that company then made a decision to change its way of doing business. And what it did was, it, with about six other companies, including Enron, Texas Utilities, Reliant, a lot of Texans actually, ran a lobbying campaign starting in Texas and running to California and then federally, which was to change the rules so that paying bribes would not be a crime. That is political donations. Did I say bribe?
Yeah.
Believe it or not, it was at one time, power companies could not make political donations. It was a crime. It was considered bribery in the U.S. There are some other changes. Oh, by the way, one little thing, because I was thinking about poor Mr. Baxter this week from Enron. This document and the payments of illegal campaign contributions were discovered by a vice president named Jay Corton in 89, and he told the company he was going to blow the whistle. For some reason, he told the company he was going to blow the whistle. The chairman of the board then asked for the company jet. 10 minutes after it took off, the jet blew up. And the company said, looks like, the company chairman told me, looks like Jake saw no other way out. But the company found a way out, so it lobbied and got rid of the laws which make political donations illegal. It got rid of the laws which regulated the price of electricity, freed the market, liberalized. And with that, with liberalization of the system came the deregulation of accounting. One of the things that they got rid of was called a document called the Uniform System of Accounts, which tells accountants where they put their accounts. And that went out the window too. So from that we end up today, no system of accounts, political donations without limit, it's legal, and of course, a so-called free market in electricity, which became a market which was, as the experts in California are telling me, Enron played games called stacking, cramming, false scheduling. For example, Enron bid to send 500 megawatts of power over a 15 megawatt power line into California once the brand new market in electricity began in California. Now you can't put 15 megawatts of power in, 500 megawatts of power into that little line, because the little line would just vaporize. Now, Enron knew that, and therefore knew that Los Angeles was about to black out, and therefore Enron knew that the power companies on the other side of the line would pay anything to keep the lights on. So the price of electricity in an hour rose about 10,000%. And who was there to sell it to them? I have to tell you. So the question is, how do we get from that to the privatization, this requirement to sell off infrastructure in Argentina, finish it off? And that's been very successful too. So because it didn't start in California. It started elsewhere. It started in Britain, then went to India, went to Pakistan, went to Brazil, and Argentina. And they had, for example, let me give you some of the great success of deregulation worldwide, of eliminating the rules, getting rid of the bureaucrats. So in Argentina, they sold off the Buenos Aires water system with the promise that this would bring in new infusions of capital, bring in the private sector, public finance initiatives, etc. And they sold off the water system to a foreign company, which immediately proceeded to lay off about 40% of the workforce. The water system started collapsing, but in the meantime, they did raise the prices in Buenos Aires enormously. That the company did have to leave because it finally was kicked out over accusations of bribery and corruption. Azurix, which was a subsidiary of Enron. They also were able to grab there was also a question about the sale of the gas pipeline in Argentina. And the public works minister in Argentina in 1988, in fact, received a call about this matter. This is the beginning of this, at the same time, of this new liberalization of markets worldwide, lack of control. And the minister, Senator Tiragno, told us on BBC that he had received a call the week after George Bush Sr. was elected president from someone with the same name who said, I'm the son of the guy who was just elected president. And the Bush administration, incoming Bush administration, would really appreciate if you would give that pipeline to a company called Enron. It's very interesting because that's 1988, and if I remember correctly, George W. said that he didn't get to know Ken Lay until 1994. Interesting words, not get to know. Now, what do we do? What we see here is a corporate crime wave. And when you have a crime wave, you usually call out the cops. One thing we call cops. Now, people talk about jail, but I have something simpler. There is one nice thing about America. One of the things I really like about coming back to America is that there are nearly 1 million lawyers. And everyone, that's a favorite standing joke worldwide about all the lawyers in America. But it is, they want you to think of it as a joke because it's your way, the average person, to get even. And that's why if they have a tort system in India that could allow, that's why for example, Bhopal victims want to be in courts in the USA. So they want to take away one of the big things that they're doing now. We're talking about adding rules for transnational corporations. There is, in the United States, something called the Alien Torts Act, which was instituted by that radical George Washington, that says a crime against humanity is a crime against the United States of America. And you can sue. And that is why, for example, the Volkswagen and Ford Motor had to pay the victims and of slave labor under the Nazi regime. Very interesting. I saw a letter from Hitler to Porsche, the head of the of Volkswagen. Porsche was complaining that he didn't get enough concentration camp people from a concentration camp for his factories. And Hitler said, "Okay, stop complaining. I'll send over some more." Actually, Hitler had stationery. He said, "Der Führer." I'm not kidding. So that's the beginning of a solution. It's there in front of us to make the court system open to everyone. I just thought I'd throw in something practical. There's another solution. There are two solutions left. One is from the deregulators and liberalizers and the free marketeers, which is they say wherever there's a problem, it's because of the bureaucrats. You have to liberalize where there's a problem. The problem in California, they said, the reason prices of electricity in California rose 400%, and San Francisco's blacked out, was that they didn't deregulate enough. Now, and that's what happened in Argentina. I talked with Joe Stiglitz, who was the chief economist of the World Bank, and he started raising some questions about the World Bank's philosophy of deregulating, eliminating the rules for corporations, selling off privatizing, and getting rid of the red tape and the bureaucrats. He said, what's really happened here? It doesn't seem to be working. They said, well, the solution for Argentina liberalization was more liberalization. And you see, liberalization today means that a nation, Argentina, which was the breadbasket of Latin America, fed the rest of Latin America. Now you have about 40% of the population, which is scrounging for garbage to eat in the streets. Stiglitz put it this way. He said, these guys, the liberalizers and the deregulators, whenever something goes wrong, their solution is more deregulation, fewer controls on the corporation. And he said, it's their medicine that they propose is quite medieval. It's just like when in medieval times, doctors would apply leeches to bleed people. And if the patient died, they said, well, he still had some blood in him. So that leads me to a final solution, which is to get rid of the bloodsuckers. Now I will open it up for a bit of discussion. And finally, I really want to thank this panel. I mean, these are activists. These are people who are really not bullshitting, but working on the ground. And one thing I'm going to ask people to do, because it was very hard for me to limit myself. You're going to have to limit yourself. If I can do it, you can do it. So try to give questions. Identify yourself if you're with an organization, just to get a sense of who's in the room. Because I know that down the street, you know, we got all the movers and shakers, and this room is filled with people I prefer, the people who represent those who are moved and shaken. So what I'd like to do is make sure that you say who you are, what you're up to, very shortly, and then ask a question, kick it open to the panel. The obvious first man up with his hand up right in front of my nose. Your name.
Hello, my name is Craig Webster, and I'm from South Africa, and I'm here with People's Mobilization in the streets of New York. And I'd like to address my question both to our comrade from Her Majesty's Government and to Yin. And my question would be that it seems to me that what we're basically addressing here is the question of democracy. In South Africa, we've seen a situation where even a People's Liberation Movement has been co-opted by an attempt to develop a sort of rich elite class at the expense of the majority of the people in South Africa. People in South Africa are having their water cut off in the midst of a cholera epidemic by the government. All right, this is a government, this is absolutely, you know, you can read in the Washington Post even.
Can people hear our... Here?
No.
No.
Maybe people could use one of these.
There's one mic there as well.
Live mic. Here. You're going to... Satu's going to do an Oprah for us. And right, I see we have... You know what I realize we do have? We have a standing microphone.
Yeah. Maybe so, people can then next to
Okay, I'll try to be very brief.
No, go right ahead.
In South Africa, we have the water supply being cut off by the government under no direct obligation of a structural adjustment program. Because of privatization, because of the attempt to move in this direction, and the people in South Africa are rising up against it. I've been involved in the grassroots resistance movement in South Africa, but there's no ability for them to have their voice. And I think what we need to recognize is that democracy around the world is not simply about governments standing up to corporations, it's about people standing up to governments, because the governments are complicit. We have to recognize that. If we don't recognize that, we won't ever really be able to have a mechanism for change. And this is the thing I'd like to ask about. When we talk about having some sort of global, centralized UN or other accounting structure at a sort of very high level, very distant from the people, my suggestion is that the only way that such a mechanism will ever actually be effective, to be implemented in a powerful way, be able to be maintained in a powerful way, and be able to be observed on the ground in a powerful way, is if there's a movement, a multitude of people in the different areas of the world who are actually democratically able to observe what's going on and to influence what's going on. And that means we have to focus on building democratic struggle. And specifically with that regard to talking about the Rio Plus 10 conference, which is being organized in a rather undemocratic way across the street, I would suggest that people might look at what's going to be happening in South Africa, which is a convergence and a mobilization in the township of Alexandra, which is one of the most politically active and economically devastated townships in South Africa, which is about 10 kilometers from Sandton, which is the wealth, which is where the Rio Platense conference is happening, which is the wealthiest suburb in the Southern Hemisphere, and people are going to march on Sandton. So what I would ask of both a comment from Her Majesty's Government and from Yin is, how do we build such a movement?
Maybe Satu could actually, well, Yin, why don't you start out with that, and maybe Satu could tell about the actual actions of his organization.
Yeah, firstly, I would agree with Greg that Satu would be an excellent person to talk about the grassroots people's movement, because the Bhopal people have been fantastic in building a widespread and also worldwidely acknowledged grassroots movement against corporate injustice. I think actually that such movements are springing up already. I mean, as we're talking here, there are thousands of people meeting in Porto Alegre in Brazil for the World Social Forum, you know, the counterpoint to the World Economic Forum here. And these movements have been growing and growing and growing. And the big leaders, the G8 leaders, for example, are very worried. I mean, look at how they reacted in Genoa. And luckily for them, you know, September 11th happened to distract people, because otherwise, you know, the movements of thousands of young people in Europe banging at the gate saying that we don't want to be part of the system anymore. Like I was saying this now, recognizing that you don't want to be part and complicit in the system of exploitation. There are thousands of people saying that, not just in the north, but also in the south. There's Thai farmers' movements going against genetic crops. You know, there's various movements in Indonesia, for example. It just keeps on going. In India, there's very, very active farmers' movements and so forth. I don't think, you know, these groups are alone. There's the People's Global Action as well, which is very active. And people need to come together. And the World Social Forum is one of these places where it happens. It's only been going on for 2 years now, is that correct? 2 years. Yeah. So, you know, it's an early day for a global scale convergence. But the global scale convergence has a lot of commonality, because they all agree where the problems are. The problems, yes, are with the unaccountable governments. It's the failure of democracy, because democracy is not about surrendering your right, your choice, to someone else, which will be, you know, easy pickings for a money-laden corporation. So, you know, it's all about changing the governments, but you need the mass movement, because governments will speak in your name, and they will speak at the UN in your name as well. So it's the grassroots movement. It's absolutely essential.
Let me just ask Satu about that. How many people belong to your organization? Is yours a mass group or affiliated with mass groups?
We are a support organization. We support the three survivors organizations who continue to struggle till today.
Who is organizing the survivors organization? How is this being put together? Who got these people together?
It started off with middle class activists who were the leaders, but within 2 years they had left the battle, and it was the survivors themselves who became to be the leaders. And today it is the survivors led by the survivors themselves. The three organizations, and mainly most of them are women members.
Very interesting. Another speaker.
Yeah, my name is Heinrich Claiborne. I'm from the Atlantic chapter of the Sierra Club, the Environmental Justice Committee. My question is that David C. Courtney has written a couple of books on the post-corporate world, and in one of them he went into great detail about how the Supreme Court back in the 1880s basically decided that corporations should have rights equal with real people. How, therefore, in this post 1880s decision, do we go about rescinding that and making it so that corporations are not equal with real people, so that we can have more control over them?
Okay, that's a U.S. legal question. But I think it's a wider question that's coming up through the General Agreement on Trade and Services Treaty about the ability of corporations to challenge national laws. We have this under NAFTA. So we're actually moving backwards on this, not forward. And I think it's one of the issues with Tony can talk a bit about the what's happening with the GATS Treaty.
A little. There's probably people in the room who are better qualified to speak on that subject than I. But I think the main point is quite correct, Greg, is that we're still moving backwards. Having spent some time following world trade negotiations, it's quite clear that the corporates have quite a lot more yet on their wish list in terms of how they wish to gain rights over democratic institutions, in terms of their right for investment opportunities, or indeed for new control over things like water services in developing countries through the GATS agreement. And yes, it's a very good question in terms of how do we try to get back some kind of balance in the system between the rights of corporations and people, but I think we've still got to stop them gaining new privileges yet before we can even ask that question. And the meeting in Doha in the Persian Gulf in November, which I think was unreported worldwide, it was a global media blackout, a few NGOs managed to go there and watch what was happening. Essentially, the developed nations, once more, being pushed by the corporations, bribed, threatened, and cajoled the developing nations into opening yet another round of trade talks on competition, investment, services, and indeed on environmental services, which looks highly dangerous, which is what we're going to have to fight over the next couple of years to stop them gaining yet more privileges before we can even start pushing back the boundaries towards establishing what you're talking about, which is rescinding those privileges. It's a long way to go. It's a very long struggle.
Me? Thank you. I'm Chai Kariwa from Desk One World, Toronto. Well, nice to see all these British accents today. It feels me nostalgic to the old era. be as it may. I think the question asked by the previous speaker is worthwhile. And the only way to bring about that kind of a challenge, really, is some people in this audience should aim for prime ministerships and presidentships. Mm. Because unless people like who have their heart in the right place get in the positions of power, I don't think it can be changed. That's the first thing I would say. Secondly, I think some comments were made about considerable, how shall I say, sue the bastards attitude, you know, get them in the courts. Well, courts have given us that decision in 1880s. So when it comes to money, don't count too much on the courts to come on your side. It will have to be legislated, I suspect. And perhaps one way of doing that might be to consider that, sunset clauses are quite popular with public. Why not have a sunset clause on all corporate charters? I mean, that will be a very simple solution. That way they will have to come back to Parliament or some committee of Parliament to get their charter renewed and explain their environmental and human rights record and so forth. That might be one easy way to do it, but difficult way to enact. Now, but of course, that's something I strongly suggest we look at. Another thing I would suggest, I think somebody asked Mr. Madden, if I'm not mistaken, let's have a convention on, what was that, corruption?
Corruption.
Yeah, and who will be against it? I tell you who, people out there on the other forum. They are the one practicing it in big scale. And if I may, we are losing public space in the global arena. There is no public space left in global arena. World Trade Organization almost can overrule the United Nations General Assembly.
It does.
It's more powerful than UN General Assembly. So our public space globally is subservient to the global private space of the corporations. To change that, why not, in Britain they have it, in India they have it, in States they have it. Let's have two houses at the United Nations and one elected house at United Nations. And maybe, just maybe, by getting an elected house at United Nations, we might get the public space globally overrule the private space, which needs a kick in the ass. Thanks.
Good. I was going to have to cut you off because you're getting a little dangerous there with those
suggestions. That was great. No, I didn't mean your private space.
You have any questions for the panel? Could you introduce yourself?
Yes. Ward Morehouse from the Bhopal Action Resource Center, which has been tracking on this side of the world what Sachin has been describing going on in India, as well as the program on corporations, law, and democracy. I want to first make clear, notwithstanding the appeal by the last speaker, that I'm devoid of any political ambition. But I do think that the time has come, and that's the real message that I take from the panel presentations this morning, for direct action. If the U.S. government can seize the assets of Al-Qaeda, why is it that, at least in the U.S., where we have a federal system and the responsibility for for chartering corporations is lodged with the 50 states, why is it that the state attorneys general cannot seize the assets of rogue corporations and use those assets to alleviate the harm that they've caused? I think that's the real lesson of the Bhopal story. After almost two decades of struggle, the victims have been hopelessly betrayed by the judicial systems of two countries so far. We have to find ways to take direct action dealing with these issues.
Thank you. I would know, in fact, we should start thinking about the issues of direct action. I say get a lawyer, but the one reason that we have to think about direct action is that they've got a lot of bullets. I know that when the IMF's World Bank's plan for privatization of water in Cochabamba, Bolivia was resisted by the people, there was a general strike, people went into the streets. Four people were shot dead by the military. People continue on. I think I get a message a day about who else has been arrested, who's in jail, who we have to make a plea for. I see this. They're not going to give up their assets so happily or willingly when you show up with balloons. We have to think about multiple levels of action, and the question is, what does it mean to take direct action? How do we go about it? How do we do it? And rather than making the suggestions, I'd like to just hear experiences in any of the communities worldwide that you've been working in. But in the meantime, we have another question.
This is just a reaction to two questions, actually. One reaction to our friend from South Africa talking about tactics of resistance. Consumers and laborers have, I'd say, three weapons that can stop businesses, governments, and armies cold, and that's the general strike, the general boycott, and the peace brigade. You know, people who just shield others with their bodies. Because yes, police have guns, but they cannot shoot everybody. The question that I had, I'm Sue Thomas from Indie Media. What's your opinion on the Tobin tax to regulate financial speculation? Do you feel that that would be a viable solution?
Any takers on Tobin? Going once, twice?
I'll say a couple of words on taxation. I think Tobin tax is a good idea. There's huge amounts of money that move around the world in speculative ways. Anything that's done, A, to slow that down, and B, to use that to raise resources that we can spend on other things has got to be a good thing. But I think we should also think about the tax system and using it in other ways. A lot of these corporations don't pay taxes in the countries they operate. They move their money around. They, you know, as we've heard, they abuse accountancy systems. So getting corporations to pay into the communities in which they're working is an important thing. And you may look at other things. One of the first actions that my government took when it came into power was to impose a windfall tax on the privatized utilities, who they believed made excessive profits out of privatization under the previous government. We came in and we put a multi-billion pound windfall tax on those utilities and used it on employment creation and social services. So there are creative things that governments can use in a positive way with the tax system.
Besides such things as taxes or Tobin taxes, an important aspect is also how the governance of finance is conducted as well. As you've seen with the report that Greg's waved on Argentina, it's very easy for a weak or vulnerable or momentarily vulnerable country to be pounced upon by the international financial institutions like the World Bank and the IMF and all these conditionalities, all these terms of terms of reference as they are, isn't it? Are served in order to break up their financial governance. And it makes them independent, because then you have to start servicing loan payments, you're given this huge amount of money that's almost impossible to pay back. But what's also needed is to encourage good practices on the parts of national governments as well, like encouraging domestic savings, because a lot of governments don't use their savings wisely. This is just a small idea which some of us have explored. But it can be used widely, because if you have a good system of domestic financing and domestic saving, you don't have to be so reliant on transnational capital. You don't have to be so reliant on transnational corporations to come in, and also the big rich countries to bargain with you with so much money. So at the same time, while we're calling for the constraints on these out of control forces, there also needs to be a build up of sustainable solutions as well, not only in finance, but also in the consumption production paradigm, which these transnational corporations help promote and sustain, because mining and oil and gas have such problems. But we shouldn't say that, we shouldn't find it acceptable that a mining or oil company accepts a voluntary code and says they'll conduct themselves well, because the production paradigm which they're sustaining is fundamentally unsustainable. It's encroaching on the rights of indigenous people, it's producing incredible pollution, environmental devastation, and these things can change. There are already solutions being made and promoted. They have to be encouraged. So the citizens' movements and the people's movements around the world not only have to strike against the powers that are holding them back and holding them down, they also have to champion the solutions, and they do already, but they need to do it more strongly as well, ensure that they are workable, that they are feasible, and there is a new vision to replace the old one.
By the way, we just heard about using taxation, windfall profits tax. It was a very good idea in which the people demanded that these power companies that were fleecing the British public first give back some of the money to fund a jobs program. Terrific idea. And it would have been a little better funded, except that there was a huge underground lobbying effort by a company called Enron. So, they're everywhere. Okay, so we've heard taxation, getting down to sustainable alternatives. Your suggestion.
Yes.
Your name, please?
My name is Olive Freud.
And are you with anyone? Everyone seems to be with someone.
Yes, I'm with the Sierra Club in New York City. One small step that we could be taking here in accountability is to try to stop the fast track movement that's going through our Congress. And in New York State, where I'm from, the Sierra Club in New York State.
Could you just quickly tell people what fast track is in two sentences?
Fast track. It's supposed to be that when the president makes an agreement, that the Senate, the Congress, looks it over and changes things or modifies it. What fast track means is the president will make the agreement and they won't bother with the Senate looking it over. That's taking away some of their constitutional rights. And the vote is coming up in the Senate. We're after our two senators here in New York State. It could be after a lot of senators to make sure that they have the responsibility and they do look it over. I have cards here if anybody wants to sign it for Clinton and Schumer in New York State. We want the Senate to vote against any fast-track trade legislation.
Thank you. And be careful. You're going to now get a call, I think, from the FBI, because Robert Zillick, the trade representative of the United States, has said that fast-track is part of is crucial to our fight against terrorism. And that I have almost the words exactly.
You'll have to read my book to get them exactly.
It's not funny.
It's not funny. He actually said that anyone who protested, I'm not kidding you, the U.S. Trade Representative is down the street now, said anyone who protested fast-track authorization for George Bush, the Lion of Kabul, was aiding the cause of terrorism. So I'm watching all of you.
You might want to meet him.
Thanks. I'm Mark Curtis from Christian Aid in London. We're running a trade campaign that includes calling for, much as Tony's talking about and others of people are talking about, bringing about legally binding regulation for international business. I have two sort of more general points to make, really. I mean, one is, in some of my private research work, I've looked into sort of the declassified British and US foreign policy plans, and there's a Treasury memorandum from the UK government from 1945 that says that we have to devise mechanisms to bring influence to bear over countries' internal decisions, as a key component of post-war foreign policy. There's various US documents that say exactly the same thing. A few years ago, Peter Sutherland, the director of the IMF, said a very similar thing, saying that we need to extend WTO rules and policies of liberalization into almost all aspects of domestic policymaking in developing and developed countries. It's very clear, the reason for mentioning that is it's very clear that what we're talking about here is challenging the real basis of Western foreign policy, which is really about empowering TNCs to gain access to southern markets. I mean, it's called various things like promoting poverty eradication and so on, but basically that's what it's about. and is very clearly detailed and articulated in the planning files for anyone that chooses to look. Now, if we are challenging that basic kind of paradigm, then I think that one of the points I wanted to make here is that there is increasingly, I think, a big difference between, you know, within the NGO community of organizations who are more keen on doing very narrow insider policy lobbying to achieve very small incremental changes, and then those who are calling for quite fundamental paradigm shifts and completely different approaches to economic policy making. And I think it's really important that we focus mainly on the latter, and particularly, you know, smaller groups, more radical groups, press the bigger agencies, you know, to do that and to maintain that need to push for fundamental changes rather than small incremental ones. The second point, which kind of relates to that more specifically on regulation, is that I think there are two qualifications, caveats to be attached to promoting global regulation. The first one, which one or two people already mentioned, is that there's a real danger in having, you know, based in New York, Washington, London, Brussels, or wherever, you know, an all-powerful global regulatory body. Because one thing that our partners say is that they want access to the law, basically, and that means you need more effective national regulation, not only international regulation, but more effective regulation at the national level, meaning southern governments. And there you come up against a whole load of difficult issues like, do they have the resources to implement effective national legislation? Because many countries like India and so on have brilliant legislation on the books that just don't implement it. So we need answers to questions like, well, how is it going to work in practice in, you know, in developing countries? I think it's a fundamental question that NGOs need to answer, because it's the first question that journalists usually ask us.
Yeah.
The second qualification on regulation is that the danger is that it legitimizes the role of TNCs in countries. Some of our partners say, well, we don't want them to be regulated, just don't want them here. You know, we need a fundamentally different approach to economic policy making that sometimes just doesn't include TNCs, however well regulated they are. So I think we need to balance, you know, the need to do more careful thinking and campaigning on regulation with articulating pro-poor economic alternatives, particularly at the local and national level, which comes back to the first point about, you know, focusing on a paradigm shift as well as sort of more details of policy making.
Thanks. Wow. While we're shifting our paradigm, that's a heavy load of items. It means we have to work on a very wide level.
Correct.
And on the particulars. So, yeah. Tony?
Yeah, just draw people's attention to this document, which has been drafted by Friends of the Earth International. It's called Towards Sustainable Economies. And you can find it out at our website, which is foei.org. And if you go towards sustainable economies, you'll find some ideas here about how you change the system in the kind of ways that Mark was talking about. So just a resource if people want to see it. Just on this question about how you generate resources in some of the poorer nations to be able to participate in a more regulated environment for companies. It was very interesting, again, going back to the experience of being in the Doha World Trade Talks, there were vast amounts of money being put on the table by the United States and the European Union, so-called capacity-building resources, which would have been there to help the poorer countries participate in liberalizing their economies to allow transnational corporations to come in and to allow them to do the legal work inside their countries to remove all the tariff barriers, to deregulate and do all the things that the European Union and the United States would have wanted them to do. So I think there's a very simple answer when people say, how is this going to be done? How can this regulation occur when countries can't even implement their own regulations right now? I think it's simply a question of demanding a switch in the resources away from liberalization towards regulation. Because if that money exists, it can be spent in quite different ways. And it could be spent to, for example, to establish a bigger jurisdiction for the International Criminal Court and to put in place a legal aid mechanism for local communities to sue transnational corporations in a neutral space internationally. It's just a question of priorities. The money is there, it's just being spent in quite the wrong way right now.
Yin, did you add something?
Yeah. While it might appear, you know, monolithic that the global capitalists rule the world and the transnational corporations are government at their beck and call, it's not actually so clear cut because, I mean, at Doha, when my organization was there as well.
Can you just say what Doha was so that Doha, you don't have the lingo?
Okay.
No,
Doha was where the last ministerial round of the World Trade Organization was held, is in Qatar, in the Persian Gulf, opposite Afghanistan. And it was clear there was incredible, and because of the media clampdown there, there was incredible bullying going on within the negotiations there. And the thing is that the WTO is not, say, something like a UN body where there's certain rules and protocols and procedures to be followed in international negotiations, where governments are still accorded some sort of respect and some sort of right. Because, you know, at the end of the day, even in the WTO, these kind of liberalization rules cannot be put into effect without the signature of governments. But what is done in order to procure that signature is outright bullying. A very partisan secretariat, the WTO secretariat, will literally, you know, write the judgments of, you know, of the vetting panel that's looking at trade disputes. You know, the secretariat itself is a judge, jury, and executioner, basically. And they're working hand in hand with the EU and the US and the transnational corporations. So, in many cases, the developing country governments didn't realize that, you know, they were facing such an unlevel playing field. But many of them are opposed to it, but it just doesn't come out in the news. It's made to look like India was you know, the only party opposing, when there were many, many other states opposing these liberalization rules. So in many ways, sometimes governments can be supported in this endeavor, sometimes they have to be opposed on domestic policies. But also to realize that at the international level, there are many people fighting. There are also many organizations, including my own, which are fighting to, you know, educate the governments on what the problems are and just what the dangers are. But at the end of the day, the battle is against us in that sense, without popular support, because the secretariat, as I said, and the rule mechanisms and these law bodies, they're all very biased. They're all there to act as a protectionist instrument. You know, there is a way maybe the WTO could be reformed or turned around to say, like, okay, why should all the developing countries liberalize for the benefit of the developed countries? Why don't the developed countries liberalize their agricultural subsidies and their imports? You know, if you want us to open up, you should open up too.
Peter. Just a very quick point, picking up on this issue of popular support and what Mark said about fundamental versus incremental change. Obviously, being inside government, I've opted for the incremental change point. But one thing that governments do, and this is true of my government, is we do respond to pressures. And we're a democratically elected government, and we do respond to what people think. And every day we poll and we investigate and we try and get a sense of what people in our country think. We also, of course, have corporate pressures and all sorts of international pressures and other pressures on us. But even though people will sign up in polls to say they care about the environment, they care about global warming, you try and get them to change the way they behave, to get out of their car, to pay more for products, to reflect their environmental costs, to pay more taxes, to invest in overseas development. It's very, very difficult, and forget it, people don't want to do it. So, you know, governments do respond, a lot of them, to democratic pressure, but you have got to bring more people with you and bring the arguments out to more people if we're going to be able to respond to those pressures.
Well, I think that's great, Peter. I think that's also true in the United States, which does not have a democratically elected president. But actually, that's an important point, because I think, now I'm throwing something in here, okay. We have to be careful. We're always thinking that the big guys win. But in fact, they want to train us in helplessness.
Yes.
Get the feeling that we can't win. They're too big. They've got the Waldorf. You know, look out, we've got the barriers, we got the comps, we got the guns, we got the money. But they don't have the people. When someone brought up General Strike, I told you about what happened in Cochabamba, the water systems there. In fact, Victor Dasa was a kid, he's 19 years old, crossing the town square and getting some bread for his mom, and a bullet caught him in the head. But the whole region went on a general strike, and Bechtel Corporation, one of the most powerful corporations on this planet, was tossed out of Cochabamba, and the privatization was reversed. You can win. They got the guns, they got the money, they got the connections. There's other ways to do it then. So very good. And Peter, here we got someone from inside saying, pressure me. That's pretty good. Yeah. You know, terrific stuff. I think it does make a difference. Next.
Hi, Greg. Name's David Boies. I work with Public Services International, which is the global union federation of 20 million public service workers in 150 countries. In terms of corporate control, we're seeing with the past 20 years of privatization that we and our members have to deal with corporations on very unwelcome terrain. A couple of comments. First on regulation, and thanks to some of the work that Greg has done in his previous life, he actually wore different clothes, was probably less nattily dressed, and was a regulator. And he provided us, and as well as others, with some very serious analysis on the problems of regulation. And it's extremely difficult to regulate these big corporations. Enron shows this is the U.S. is a country with the strongest civil society organizations. The rule of law apparently predominates, and you can force corporations to reveal information and to change things. And even here, you can't regulate these guys. So how are you going to do it in Zimbabwe or even South Africa is very, very difficult. But what I wanted to share with this group is a little bit of the work we've been doing in water, because I think the issue of public control of water could be the Trojan horse for a lot of our work. There are two main multinational corporations in water. They're both French, Suez and Vivendi. Also, Suez has changed its name. Rebranding is one of the things they do to avoid bad press. Ondeo, it's known as. And they make billions off water, tons and tons of money. So there's a couple of levels where we operate. The first thing that we do is we track wherever they are in the world. And we spend a lot of money doing this. Just Vivendi, on its water and other environmental services subsidiaries, we have 30 pages of subsidiaries. And they're not all called Vivendi. They're called everything in the world. And they are very, very good at getting around the world, at hiding themselves, at making money, at lobbying. They're excellent. So the tracking is essential to know who they are, where they are, what they're doing. It takes a lot of money and a lot of work, but it must be done. But then what do you do with that? We take this to not only our affiliates in all the countries, but also to various NGOs. We provide comparative analysis of what they're doing, the impact of their practices on water services from the level of quality, access, pricing, democratic control, corruption. And we distill this analysis and then make that available. So that is very powerful tools, because typically national governments don't know who these guys are, even though they'll come in and privatize. National unions don't know who they are. NGOs don't know who they are, and they bank on this. So it's getting people to know who they are and that what they're doing in your country, they're doing everywhere else. The same thing on Enron. We provided a briefing to some of the pension funds in the U.S. that what they did in California, they'll do in any country and have done in every country. So the Californians think, well, why us? Well, because this is a business practice and they know they can maximize profits. So that's one area where information on the corporations, and I know a number of NGOs do it very well, but the point about water is it's such a unique resource. There's nothing else that's so fundamental to life, that public ownership and control of that is absolutely essential, that access to water should not be made dependent on the market, on ability to pay. However, we do admit we run into problems. A number of countries' public services are not good. And so how then do we reform? So not only do we have to criticize what's going on with the commodification of water, but we also have to plan on and make projects to reform the public sector. And this is, again, where we need to involve everybody. Reference quickly to Cochabamba. Yes, Bechtel is out. Okay, what's left? Here we have a coordinadora that is willing to involve the people in rebuilding the water system, yet they have huge debt, they have massive infrastructure problem. Nobody's going to lend them a dime. The World Bank was the buddies with Bechtel. Why are they going to go and lend money to La Coordinadora, which is basically a city-based? So also, we have to operate at the level of the World Bank and the WTO, but we have to, and we're making progress on this, say to the World Bank, not only do you impose water, do you stop imposing privatization of water as a condition for country loans, which they basically did in Bolivia, which they're doing in a number of countries, but also that you make funds available to build public infrastructure, and that you use other public companies, you make networks of public companies So again, there's the three levels that we have to work: one on the companies, one on the community, and one on the World Bank. And I think that water, and I make a special call to Friends of the Earth on this, I think water is a really, really good case to fight a lot of the things WTO, World Bank, corporate control, public government. I've spoken too long, but I make that call for it.
Terrific, David. Just to note on that, you said research, they know what the heck you're talking about. Work on several levels, but David's presence here from Public Service International is a very important lesson. Coordinate with labor unions. It's terrific that David is here for the international unions. And there has been a bit of standoffishness often between labor unions and some of the activist groups. So we've got a lot of coalition building to do on that. So it's great. So David's here, and he's throwing out a practical route to take, that we take on the issue of water. And those guys every year say, we have an issue. And 2 years ago, they made it water. We're going to take all the damn pipes. And Enron, Asterix, Suez, under whatever new alias they're running on, Vivendi, etc. We could do the same. Maybe we'll have to say this is our year of water campaigning, so that it's not just anti-WTO per se, but that we have particular issues. I don't know. Well, maybe that's wrong.
Can I say something about water? We've got a privatized water system in the UK. We didn't privatize it, and we wouldn't have, but we inherited a privatized system. And what I like to say is that sometimes you need to look at what are the outcomes that you want for the consumer, the environment, and the labor force, so on, rather than necessarily who owns it. Because our experience since taking over water is that we've cut bills for consumers by 15%, cut leakage by a third, we've had multi-billion pound investment in environment, we've got the cleanest beaches.
Is this Britain?
Rivers. This is Britain, the cleanest beaches, rivers. Okay. For 200 years, and that's the fact, and that's because of how we've regulated these companies, and we've been tough, and we've regulated for outcomes that we want to deliver for the citizen and the environment, and governments have the power and the ability to do that. So it's not always my experience that if the water company is owned by the brother-in-law of the president, that it's somehow going to deliver better for the environment and for the for people than if it's privatised.
Well, Friends of the Earth also opposed that privatisation during the late 1980s, and there was a furious public debate about the way in which the privatisation of water would lead to these kinds of outcomes, and it led to a very regulated environment. And I think that's the main point that Peter and I would agree on, is that because there was such a furore about this, it did lead to very serious constraints being put on these companies. But the fact remained, even though they were regulated, even though they were forced to invest in pollution cleanup, even though they were forced by regulation to cut leakage rates, the fact that they're selling something which is so fundamental to people's life, water, you can't get any more fundamental than that, they were guaranteed to still make a profit. And I think to that extent it's a pretty unique industry. But I thank you for that comment about water and us looking at it. I think we will do. And you're right. Certainly in many of the developing countries there's big issues about how corporate regulation, international finance and basic services mesh together. And it's something that we'll look at more. But I think the situation in the UK is quite unique. It has to be said. I wouldn't use it as a model for other nations.
Next.
Hi, my name is Kelly Vaughn, and I'm from the American Friends Service Committee in Chicago. And one of the things that we really try to do in Chicago is make connections between global institutions like we're talking about here today and local issues. So I'd just like to make the comment, although it's fairly obvious, it has not yet been stated, that a lot of the problems of privatization that we're talking about internationally are happening in our own communities. There's hospitals in Arizona and Washington, D.C. and Chicago being privatized. There's people right here who don't have access to services. So I would just challenge us in terms of trying to get the people and build this movement to really go into our own communities and listen to the issues of those people who are struggling day to day and try to connect them to things like the World Economic Forum. Because it seems obvious that some of the folks protesting the World Economic Forum should be all of the local people here in New York who are being drastically affected. Yet we continually don't see those faces, and I think that's in part due to how we organize. So I would challenge myself, but also everybody in this room, really to try to make those connections strongly. And I know the beginnings of that are happening, and I appreciate that. But I think it's something that we have to work on a little bit harder.
I'm going to take the one last comment, and then we're going to wrap it up so people can get the press conference.
Hi, my name is Tom Reich from Focus on the Global South, and I just wanted to address the issue of regulation. People have mentioned the passage of the law declaring the corporation a person. But actually, Morton Horowitz of Harvard University is a law professor, argues what was much more important is the New Jersey amendment to the New Jersey Corporation Law of 1889, which basically allowed corporations to do whatever they wanted and led to the migration of about 700 corporations to New Jersey worth $1 billion. That's the problem of international regulation, basically. That with capital mobility, unless you have some sort of international regime, you have a problem. And I think one important point to note now is that a lot of U.S. foreign policy, which is now being increased again supposedly to increase security, has actually been violating human rights of people around the world, allowing corporations to go there. And I think in the context after September 11th, that people involved in the movement around globalization have to be making the argument that U.S. foreign policy has not increased our security. We have to have a different vision of things that do increase our security by protecting basic fundamental human rights, and that has to be a regime protecting people against capital mobility so corporations can do anything they wanted. And I'd especially want the representative from Third World Network to talk a little bit about their work on the WTO and how they see kind of this movement linking to a kind of international regime which protects basic human rights, and also talks about dismantling the transnational corporation, possibly, or inventing a new mode of economic governance. Thank you.
Great. That will be the last question of the panel. Can you answer that? Maybe shot two?
Let me just check if my colleague Chen Yan is around, because he's the economics expert. Chen Yan, are you here? No? Okay. Let's see. Yeah, like I said earlier, as the gentleman from Focus on Global South said, U.S. foreign policy has not increased security within the U.S. It goes back to my earlier point about the dependency created within all countries by the system of international financing and companies. I mean, when the Asian crisis happened in 1997, the U.S. bailed out long-term capital management because the amount of risk that was hedged around the world threatened to collapse the U.S. economy. The attempt to just make more and more money by just funneling huge amounts of volatile investments into the economies of other countries is also creating a very great insecurity in the U.S. as well. I mean, luckily the U.S. has enough funds to bail it out when it needs to, but those funds are not limitless. And they're already facing crisis now with Enron as well. So the whole thing has to change. But there also needs to be solutions marked out. Like we had an example from the UK, for example, where some regulations have worked, but as Tony said, it's not a model for everywhere. But then we also have to stop the public services, for example, and local companies. And it's not just the big companies that should occupy our minds. Also, what's happening to small and medium industries? Because small and medium industries, small farmers, for example, comprise the majority of economic productivity for most of the world, especially the developing world. And these large pockets of little activity sustain our world. And it's the companies that really need to change. I think we can dismantle the corporations and still survive. It's entirely possible because we've done it. We've lived thousands of years without them.
Well, we can't keep.
We have it in the U.S., and we know that the right-to-know laws were essentially a response of the Bhopal disaster. And that is how right-to-know came to be for the U.S. citizens. But what is interesting here, that while Bhopal had this, presented his right-to-know to the U.S. citizens, even today, Union Carbide is withholding the information on the leaked gases and what do they do to the bodies. Even today, Dow does not disclose. In fact, suppresses information and says it's okay for pets and children. So while the right to know exists for the last how many years? Many, many years there. In India, they do not have to disclose anything. And in fact, go on with suppressing information.